Doings of Doyle is sponsored by Belanger Books, home of the best Sherlock Holmes anthologies featuring today's top Sherlockian authors. Belanger Books is the only authorised publisher of Solar Ponds Mysteries, continuing the Sherlock Holmes legacy into the 21st century. Visit them today at belangerbooks.com. Welcome to Doings of Doyle, a podcast dedicated to the works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Professor Challenger, Brigadier Gerard, and, of course, Sherlock Holmes. I'm Mark Jones.
And I'm Paul Chapman. And together we'll be exploring Doyle's eclectic bibliography to understand more about the great man's life and work. We'll be discussing his fiction and non-fiction, the well-known and the obscure.
And stopping by Baker Street along the way. You can find out more at doingsofdoyle.com or follow us at doingsofdoyle on Twitter. Hello and welcome to episode 49. This month, we're making a minor detour from our announced episode to take in a classic Conan Doyle short story, one the author felt was gloomy but of his best, The Pot of Caviar from 1908. And here's Paul to set the scene.
During the Boxer Rebellion in China in 1900, the small European garrison of Yichao is barely holding out against a besieging Boxer army. A relief force is expected, but its progress is uncertain. Hope and fears both run high, and the defenders begin to weigh up their options. Relief, death, or capture by a merciless foe.
And this episode is going to be especially spoilerific, so if you haven't read the story, do yourself a favour and read it online at the Arthur Conan Doyle Encyclopedia before embarking on our witterings. Now, The Pot of Caviar is an unusual story in that it appeared pretty much from nowhere as one of those short stories that Conan Doyle would every now and then send to the Strand magazine when an idea occurred to him. He'd been relatively prolific a few years earlier, writing The Return of Sherlock Holmes in 1903-4 and Sir Nigel in 1905-6, but his output had reduced to nothing following the death of his first wife, Louise, in July 1906. Now, just over a year later, in September 1907, he married Jean Leckie, and the family moved to their new home, Windlesham, in Crowborough, East Sussex. And one of the first projects Conan Doyle completed in Windlesham was The Pot of Caviar, which he finished in December 1907. Writing to his mother, he described it as very gloomy, but of my best. Now, while Caviar sits in relative isolation from his other works, it does foreshadow some of the work Conan Doyle was about to embark upon. With its central theme of the evil of defeatism, it foreshadows the collection Tales of Long Ago, which includes stories written from 1911 to the early 1920s, and are together laments on imperial decline. The Pot of Caviar is not exactly a tale of long ago, being set only 7 years before it was written, but it can be seen as a prologue of sorts to that later collection of stories. The story itself was first published in the Strand magazine in March 1908, and the Strand, in typically effusive mode, advertised it as perhaps the best short story he has ever written. It included three illustrations by Richard Catton Woodville, or RCW as he signed his illustrations. Woodville had worked for the Cornhill and the Illustrated London News, and he was renowned for his battle scenes. He would go on to create a notable panoramic piece for Conan Doyle's The British Campaign in France in 1916. And he'd already provided several illustrations for early Conan Doyle stories, including Uncle Jeremy's Household and An Exciting Christmas Eve.
Yeah, well, I mean, Woodville is a really interesting artist as well, because he created one of the great iconic images of Empire, which is always tied in with the Boer War, which is a picture of a defiant Tommy stood with his Foreign Service helmet at his feet and a bandaged head. And it's entitled A Gentleman in Khaki. And was reproduced on an awful lot of commemorative wear during the Boer War, usually in conjunction with Kipling's poem, The Absent-Minded Beggar. Mm. So the two, you know, the picture is officially A Gentleman in Khaki, but often is referred to as The Absent-Minded Beggar because it ties in with this. And it became one of the real strong pieces of imperial iconography. You know, it's up there with Alfred Leet's poster of Lord Kitchener, Wanting
yes,
You.
Yes, pointing at the audience, yes. Yeah, yeah. So not long after that first publication with Woodville's illustrations, Conan Doyle revised the short story as a play, this time entitled A Pot of Caviar, which was first performed in the USA in 1908 and 2 years later at the Adelphi Theatre in London. And we'll come back to the play a little bit later. When it came to being collected, The Pot of Caviar was first included in Conan Doyle's Round the Fire stories in 1908, which was an anthology of Gothic pieces published over the preceding 10 years. The Pot of Caviar was actually the most recent story to be included in the collection, having only appeared in the Strand 6 months earlier. And the story received a great deal of praise, with Dr. Robertson Nicol in the British Weekly writing, "Conan Doyle has lost none of his skill. He can tell a story as no other writer of his time can tell it, without superfluity, without tedium, with unerring skill and point."
Yeah, so we've got it first anthologized, as you say, in the Round the Fire stories, and you wonder if this is just almost seen as a filler for that collection, which had been long mooted. It was originally going to be published by Grant Richards years earlier, but ended up being published by Smith Elder, as you say, in 1908. And the Gothic tone of the story lends itself very much to that setting. Later on in the 1920s, when John Murray is producing a number of anthologies of Conan Doyle's short stories, the story is moved to Tales of the Ring and Camp, which is a more sort of adventure themed anthology. So the military and imperial background is at the forefront rather than the Gothic, the underlying Gothic subtext. So you can see this the way Conan Doyle is thinking. He's obviously looked at the story again and thinks it fits more in this context now. It stays in that context when the giant anthology, the Conan Doyle stories, is issued. So again, in that, it's in the section Tales of the Camp. It's in company with stories like A Straggler of 15, The Green Flag, The Three Correspondents, and The Marriage of the Brigadier. And interesting also, The Lord of Chateau Noir, which was another sort of mix of Gothic and Gothic adventure. So it sits comfortably there as well. But it just shows the flexibility of the story and the fact that for such a short story, really, it touches a number of bases.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Now, to begin, let's have a look at the historical context for this story. As Paul said at the beginning, it's set in the Boxer Rebellion, which was an anti-foreign, anti-imperialist uprising in North China between about 1899 and 1901. And it really came to a head in June 1900 with the very famous Siege of Peking, or Beijing, as we would call it today. But the origins of the Boxer Rebellion lie almost half a century earlier.
Yeah, it really begins in the 1830s with British involvement in China. It's essentially all tied into Britain's control of India and the expansion of markets in the Far East, and the British demanding access to Chinese markets. It's often characterized as the British wanting to force opium on China because they had a surplus of it. That's part of it, but it's not the whole story. It's basically about pushing trade, most of all, and this clashes with nationalist Chinese ideas. And leads to the outbreak in 1839 of what is known as the First Opium War, or the First China War, which runs from 1839 to 1842, and is settled with a number of treaty ports being handed to the British. Yes. There's a further upheaval in 1856 with the Second China War, when we're also known as the Arrow War because of the Chinese seizure of a ship called the Arrow, which leads to another shorter war. This has a bit of a respite, and then in 1859 breaks out again into the Third China War, which is the decider. That really settles things for a number of decades afterwards. But the Third China War is particularly striking because it was an Anglo-French war. We were allied to the French in this one, because the French were also pushing into China. They had their interests in Southeast Asia, in what was then known as Indochina, which is modern-day Vietnam, Kampuchea, and Laos. So these two expansionist empires were pushing into China at the time. And then after that period, you've got a further growth in foreign influence with the new nations of Germany and Italy.
Yes.
Also wanting to push their claims on parts of China. So the Chinese, understandably, were feeling overwhelmed.
Yes.
And aggrieved about this European pushing into their territory.
Yes.
And as I say, at the end of the Third China War, things calmed down a bit, but you've still got this bubbling under of discontent. And at the head of the later discontent is this organization which were known as the Boxers, the Fists of Righteous Harmony.
Yes.
Who were called the Boxers by the British because of that name, and also because they did a form of martial arts involving shadow boxing.
Yes. Yes.
So it's usual sort of lazy shorthand.
Yes, indeed.
Essentially. And in the end the Boxers break into open rebellion in late 1899, murdering a number of priests. Particularly, yes. Because this was the other cultural imposition,
yes,
that was put upon China is European missionaries coming in, both Protestant and Catholic, and they'd muddied the waters, and they, you know, they'd also been responsible in a way for what remains the bloodiest civil war in history, which was the Taiping Rebellion.
Yes,
which
yes.
broke out in 1851 when a clerk known as Hong Zhuquan failed his examinations, went into some form of breakdown, and then believed himself to be Jesus's brother.
Yes,
and formed the Taiping and went into rebellion against the imperial government, and that carried on between 1851 and 1866. So that's in the background of all this as well. So it's just a very very chaotic and bloody period.
Yes, and the last few years of the 19th century are particularly divisive because you have the Sino-Japanese War 1895-6, which really reveals how weak the Qing dynasty is with the Japanese victory. And on the back of that, you have some very aggressive European imperialism, particularly the Germans at that point, really pushing very aggressively into China. I think Kaiser Wilhelm is talking about potentially partitioning China in the same way as we've had the scramble for Africa at that time. So there are all these tensions as well. I mean, there's also the fact that there's been very poor hot harvests and summers, so the peasantry are essentially in an incredibly poor way as well, which sort of heightens the tension, doesn't it, towards the end of the towards the end of the century. I mean, it's worth saying as well, when the Boxer Rebellion starts, I think the first targets are actually the Chinese Christian converts, and then you get to the European missionaries, and also the Americans, because there were quite a lot of Americans in there as well. The Americans had really followed into China on the back of the Treaty of Nanjing at the end of the First Opium War, which had really opened the gates for other powers to come in and take their slice, essentially. So that's why I think when we get to the Pot of Caviar and the characters around the table, you have the American in there as well as you have the Europeans.
And you also have the, as you say, with the Chinese converts, that you don't have any of them as characters per se in this story, but you've got that Chinese element. As I've just said, with the a lot of what's going on here is internal Chinese infighting,
yes,
as well, as I say, with the Taiping Rebellion, and then at the time of the Boxer Rebellion, you've got an infant emperor, so the country is in the hands of the Dowager Empress Zhu Xi,
yes,
and she can't be seen to openly support the Boxers,
no,
because they're a rebellious force, but there is tacit imperial approval.
Yes,
and the Boxers are used by particularly Zhu Xi and her advisors to try and attain their own ends.
Yes, and this particularly comes to a head with the famous Siege of Peking, which lasted 55 days. Mm-hmm. As anybody who has seen the movie will know, 55 days at Peking from 1963, starring Charlton Heston and David Niven, Nova Gardner. But which has some very improbable casting of Flora Robson as the Dowager Empress Zhu Xi. But yeah, the Siege of Peking is probably the most famous component of the Boxer Rebellion. And we'll probably come back to how the news of the Siege of Peking really has informed views of China for the best part of 100 years. Informed the sort of depiction, particularly the notion of the quote yellow peril, as we'll come back to later.
And it's very striking as well that you've got, as we've said, the competing European empires, but they pull together.
Yes.
Very briefly, for this siege. So you've got elements from Britain, America, Germany, Italy, Austria-Hungary, Russia, and Japan.
Yes.
Are all besieged in the legation quarter in Peking and pull themselves together. And it's this, despite all the tensions of the time. Because you think this is also the time Britain is fighting the Boer War.
Yes. Yeah.
So Britain is under siege in terms of propaganda from the Germans and the French and the Dutch at the time, who were all opposed to Britain's involvement in the Boer War. And yet those differences are forgotten.
Yes.
In the middle of this conflict. And then you think very shortly afterwards, you've got Russia and Japan.
Yes.
They're going to go to war with each other in 1904, which is really going to change the imperial balance of power further. Yeah. So it's a fascinating mix, what's going on here.
Yeah, and the Siege of Peking really does sort of give this impression of the European forces coming together, because there were, in total, I think, 900 civilians, about 2,800 troops from, I think, nine nations, European nations, and I think the Americans in there as well. Mm. They then had to essentially divide up the legation compound, which was the diplomatic area not far from the Forbidden City, and essentially defend themselves. While they were well stocked on food, but very short on ammunition and medicine. And it's that story is told brilliantly by Peter Fleming, the brother of Ian Fleming. Mm. In the Siege of Peking, and he describes in there the many sort of hair-raising sorties that individuals had to make into enemy territory to try to recover supplies, just to be able to hold out very long. When talking about Allied strategy or lack of, Peter Fleming has a very amusing line in the book about the relief expeditions owing more to G.A. Henty than to Klaus Fitz.
What's particularly great about that is that in 1903, G.A. Henty published a novel on the theme with the Allies to Peking, a story of the relief of the legations. So he was very much in touch with what was going on.
But interestingly, Conan Doyle doesn't set this story in Peking. He sets it further out. He sets it out at Yichao, which is, I think, a fictional part of, but it would be logically sort of northeast of Peking or Beijing today. And so it probably would have been one of the first areas to have encountered the Boxers. Mm. So you're at the kind of raw end of the Boxer Rebellion in this story.
Mm. What he seems to have done with this story as well is just take the idea, as you say, of the Siege of Peking and miniaturize it.
Yes.
So that it's manageable as a short story.
Yes.
And you can just have a small number of characters, each of whom represents a certain country or a certain type of character. It's all very, very cleverly put together.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is. And there's another inspiration for this story, which is close at home, in that Conan Doyle's younger brother, Innes, served in the sort of mop-up campaign in China, although he didn't really see all that much action. Innes, or John Francis Innes Hay Doyle, was 14 years Conan Doyle's junior, and Conan Doyle seems to have had a particularly paternal outlook for Innes. Obviously, their father had by then succumbed to his illness. And so when Conan Doyle went into practice in Southsea, he took Innes under his wing. Innes eventually went and studied at Woolwich and obtained his commission with the Royal Field Artillery in 1893. But he was posted to India in 1899 where he was promoted from lieutenant to captain. And he was joined there by their sister Lottie, who housed for him before she met her future husband, who was a member of the Royal Engineers in Nagpur, I think it was. But it was shortly after Lottie married that he and the 12th Battery of the Royal Artillery were moved to China to take part in the mop-up campaign. He really didn't see very much action at all. In fact, there is a surviving letter which was included in the Christie's catalogue, dated January 1901, when he'd arrived at Peking. And in it he says, "I went over the Forbidden City the other day and was not impressed at all. The Chinese are friendly, but most annoying on the golf course, where they retrieve your ball with greatest zeal."
Which I'm afraid makes Innes sound somewhat of a Philistine.
Just a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this all comes across afterwards as all, you know, kind of lighthearted and amusing. But you know, the actual campaigning around Peking and Tientsin had been pretty hairy stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a genuinely dangerous theatre of war. And Conan Doyle himself had been worried about his brother. I mean, he wrote to their mother. You heard, of course, that Innes was sent straight on from Hong Kong to Wei Hai Wei. "It will be very cold there. I tell him he has evidently been sent to overawe Russia." And then he wrote to Innes himself, "I shall be so anxious to hear from you and to know what is on the cards. Do they expect trouble in the north with Boxers, or have they sent you to overawe Russia, or what is it?" Mm. So he's, you know, there's genuine worry going on there. Conan Doyle is saying both to Mary Doyle and to Innes, that, oh, perhaps he's been sent over there to overawe the Russians. Mm. And of course, his job out there was actually combat against the Chinese rebels.
Yes.
And the Russians were actually allies of the British. But what may be going on here is that in the air at this time, we're talking 1900, is this idea of the what was essentially the Victorian Cold War, known as the Great Game, which was the ongoing kind of secret conflict between Russia and Britain in the northwest frontier of India and Central Asia.
Yeah.
And this had been reflected culturally at this time in two novels. One of them was an early novel by John Buchan, The Half-Hearted, which was published in 1900, which has a great game theme. But perhaps even more significantly is Kipling's masterpiece, Kim, which is the great game novel, published in 1901. So these ideas were very much out there and in the public sphere. So yeah, public awareness of this whole story between Russia and Britain is also very strong. So it's just this whole complication of the time, the kind of battles between empires, the confusion of the whole era is really encapsulated here.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Well, I think that's a good point to leap into the story itself. And our setting, as we said before, is Yichao, which is in the provinces outside of Peking. And the whole setup here is really exploring the tension and the camaraderie between the allied powers, the European nation and the Americans, that are all located in what is described as an absurd little garrison consisting of native Christians and railway men, with a German officer to command them and five civilian Europeans to support him, who held on bravely with the conviction that help must soon come sweeping down to them from the low hills to eastward. And so you have people like Ainslie, who is in the British diplomatic service, and Ralston, who's another Britisher of the railway company. You have Colonel Dresler of the Hanoverian infantry. You have Professor Mercer, an American, or specifically a Californian, who was both a doctor and an entomologist, which is, you know, yet another example of a Conan Doyle doctor and entomologist connection. You get that in Gastafel and Beetle Hunter as well. You've got Miss Sinclair, who's a Scots Presbyterian, Father Pierre of the French mission, and Mr. and Mrs. Patterson and their daughter, Jessie, and a number of Chinese Christian servants as well. And Conan Doyle almost sets up that small grouping so that you have the tensions. You've got both the Presbyterian and the Catholic tensions in there. But you've also got the great camaraderie that comes together. Towards the end, you know, there is a speech, I think, from Ralston, where he talks about we've learned to appreciate each other and we've learned to appreciate each other's nations. There's the colonel here stands for Germany and Father Pierre is for France. Then there's the professor for America. Ralston and I are Britishers. Then there's the ladies, God bless them. And it seems to be particularly pointed that this should be told in a story that's written in 1908 at a time when, you know, European tensions are on the rise. And the rivalries and the civilities between the countries are really coming to the fore.
And you've got, again, symbolism here. Of course, Germany has to be represented by the military officer. It's kind of German militarism personified. You've got France represented by a Catholic priest. So you do have these tropes coming in, and I find the religious element particularly interesting because as I commented earlier, this is one of the main causes of the Boxer Rebellion is Christian incursions into China. But then you've got here the classic Presbyterian or Protestant Catholic divide. And you've got these two not speaking to each other almost at times. And the craziness of that. And this probably also reflects something of Conan Doyle's own upbringing. He'd have seen this in, you know, he grew up in Edinburgh, which is predominantly more Protestant part of Scotland, in a Catholic family. So he's experienced this throughout his life, this kind of dichotomy of belief, and places this quite importantly in this story. It is the real tensions tend to come between that rather than between nations.
Yes, there's a bit of one-upmanship, isn't there, at the beginning where they talk about, you know, who they hope is going to be leading the rescue party. And obviously, Dresler is saying, you know, well, if they're led by a German, it will be fine. And Father Pierre is saying, well, I've heard that the French Commodore is very good. And so there's obviously this kind of one-upmanship. But but at the end of the day, they're all able to sort of settle their differences, or you know, as they think anyway. But of course, what's at the heart of this story is how the individuals themselves respond to the pressured situation in which they find themselves. And the person who breaks in this situation is Professor Mercer, the American doctor and entomologist, who's got previous experience of being besieged in China. He talks fleetingly about having been involved in Sung Tong in South China in 89, which I think is an entirely fictional.
Yes, because this was really a kind of one of the quiet periods when there was little major trouble going on in China.
But he talks about being sort of in besieged situation, and there's a wonderful moment in that where I think Ralston asks, you know, how was the siege lifted? And Mercer says it wasn't, and reveals that actually he was only spared because he was a doctor, but he witnessed the most appalling tortures and horrors and murders on the back of this, which of course sets up the pivotal moment of this story, which is when a messenger from the relief force arrives, and the party, or at least Dresler and Mercer, believe that maybe help isn't coming, and in fact they are going to quickly fall to the Boxers. Mercer, of course, horrified at the thought that he will live again through the terrors he witnessed last time, decides that it would be better to kill everybody in the party, and he decides to lace his pot of caviar with cyanide. And of course, the whole point of this is that it's a treatise on defeatism. At the end of the day, it's about you know, what do you do in this situation, and what are the personal choices that you make? And it is interesting because there is, again, this kind of religious element to it, in that obviously for a Catholic, then suicide is a great sin. And in fact, you do get that reflected elsewhere in Conan Doyle's work, notably in the Veiled Lodger, where Sherlock Holmes turns around to Eugenia Rhonda and says, "Your life is not your own. Keep your hands off it." But here it is that essentially the professor dies both a suicide and indeed a multiple murderer, mm-hmm. because he's managed to take most of virtually all of the party with him. In the final moments of the story, and it is a truly harrowing end to the piece. But of course, the message there is very strongly about holding out and not being defeatist,
and obviously loaded with irony and comment. The one survivor, Jessie, survives because she doesn't like caviar.
Yes,
and then there's another nice little aside where her mother shows greed.
Yeah.
Oh, if you don't want it, I'll have it.
Yes.
And gets a double dose. So, yeah, it's all kinds of really fun little stuff going on in this grim story. There's a lot of interesting little plays with irony.
There are. The ending, I think, is genuinely shocking. I remember reading this the first time as a young boy and not really knowing what was going on. I mean, I think nowadays reading it, it's quite easy, I think, to guess what the twist would be, but it has a rather wonderful kind of Tales of the Unexpected type quality to it.
Mm. And it's the other influence that I can see in here is it's a very French story, and to me, it's very very much in touch with a lot of Doyle's earlier work, which we've discussed before, things like The Case of Lady Sannox, where there's the influence of the French writers, the writers of particularly of Conte Cruel, which Doyle really enjoyed, and this kind of clever twisting. So you've got the influence of people like Villiers de l'Isle-Adam and Doyle's favourite Guy de Maupassant again, definitely in the twist. Because De Maupassant loves his
twist.
Sudden dark twist at the end, and that's what you get here quite definitely.
Yes, and I said at the beginning that this could easily be a kind of Tales of Long Ago, though it's not obviously set long ago. Mm. In that it's dealing with some of those Conan Doyle's concerns about the threats to empire or fears of imperial decline. He often is interested. At this point, I think, in things that are much more about internal threats to empire, about being divided as a country or being defeatist in this case. I guess it's quite similar as well to another story around this period, which we covered in episode 4, which is Danger, in the sense that that's a sort of contemporary story, in that case about lamenting the British lack of preparedness for a naval conflict. He's using his fiction at this time to sort of give a salient lesson and hope that people will actually learn from this and think twice when faced in a similar kind of situation.
And it not only ties into themes in Danger, it also ties into his novel The Tragedy of the Krosko, which is set in the Sudan in the 1890s, which has a party of tourists on a Nile cruise, are kidnapped by Islamic extremists, and taken into the heart of the Sudan, and the whole point there is about different nations joining together. You've got a multinational group of tourists,
yes,
and it's about them pulling together. And we've got a similar sort of thing here. Although I do, obviously, both stories do have that they are perhaps overpopulated by British characters.
Yes,
given the groups, but nevertheless, the point is there to be made about the pulling together of European nations, and we know particularly with Conan Doyle, Britain and America. I mean, both Carrasco and Pot of Caviar have American characters in, although the American character in Pot of Caviar is perhaps atypical.
Yes.
Because he is a pessimist.
Yes, it's very odd, isn't it?
It's unusual for an American character in a Conan Doyle story. But nevertheless, you have this grouping, and it's also, you wonder if tying into The Last Galley and these stories of empire, where it's as if you can almost see the First World War approaching.
Yes.
But there's this idea of what are we doing? We should be coming together.
Yes.
And the threat is out there. It is the other. And the threat is both in Tragedy of the Crossbow and in Pot of Caviar. The threat is the East.
Yes.
This external threat. And the, you know, he's going through, it's almost like he's going through these ideas in his head.
Yes.
And playing with them in fiction. And this the ideas are very clear there, and tying into again this cultural idea of the threat from the East, which would come out in particular with Pot of Caviar. It is what Professor Christopher Frayling has termed Chinaphobia.
Yes, yeah.
At this time, and this kind of demonizing the Chinese, and they're monsters of depravity, and the usual sort of pulp fiction stuff about these sort of characters. And you get this with Mercer describing his previous siege, where I have seen the torture of the eggs, I have seen the torture of the boiling kettle. It's all this stuff that's going to come up later on with Sax Rohmer's Fu Manchu novels, which begin in 1913. This kind of idea of the, you know, the death of a thousand cuts, all this kind of stuff, is at play here, this is what I feel more this story is about. Is about, you know, the imperial powers should come together. And that's what the siege at Peking can be seen as symbolically, even though it was an alliance of necessity.
Yeah, that's right.
In reality.
I mean, it's interesting you should say about the Chinaphobia. I mean, there's a question here as to how far Conan Doyle is complicit in propagating that same impression here. I mean, actually, one of the things that, one of the you know, particularly unpleasant parts of the story of the Boxer Rebellion is a Daily Express report from 16th of July 1900, which was called the Peking Massacre. And it was a false story that was put out saying that the diplomatic compound had been breached and everybody inside had been murdered. But one of the most unpleasant parts of the story was the suggestion that the European and American men had first killed their wives and children to save them from the tortures and the punishments that would follow. And that story got widespread circulation. And it was maybe a week later when it was unpicked, but by then it had kind of had an impact in the popular imagination. And this is something that then does follow through, as you say, into Fu Manchu and into other depictions of the East, in brackets, you know, because obviously how we see China and how we see Japan are very different. In fact, it's worth saying that, you know, that the whole term, the Yellow Peril, had really come about in the last 5 years of the 19th century on the back of, well, really had been popularized by Kaiser Wilhelm II, hadn't it? In particular, he had used an illustration, an allegorical lithograph called "Peoples of Europe, Guard Your Most Sacred Possessions" by Nackfuss. It sort of showed, I think it's St. Michael for Germany, leading the symbolic powers of Europe against the evils of China. But he'd used it to very much promote and justify European colonialism in China. And that has has echoes right through to the present day.
I mean, at this time as well, you've got in this sort of fiction, particularly, you know, Chinese characters will be there for one of two purposes. They're either comic, and you're getting that in Innes's letter about the golf course. To Kunda, or they're sinister.
Yes,
and the Fu Manchu types, and obviously in this story, it's black and white stuff. There's no shades of grey with it. Or those Chinese who are with the Chinese Christians who are with the garrison are just shadows. You don't get any sense of them as people at all. They're just there as props and shadows.
Yes, yeah. Well, unfortunately, Conan Doyle does succumb to that in the 1880s when he's adapting a play based on Study in Scarlet and has some particularly unpleasant Chinese racist tropes in that play as well. Mm. There's also the kind of fascination as well as the horror that comes into Orientalism. We're right at the end of the sort of peak of Orientalism at this point in time. I was reminded of the fact that, you know, Buffalo Bill's Wild West performers would be dressed as boxers. Mm. They would have had the same white and red outfits and played on that, much to the delight of the visiting audience, and you know, playing entirely on that horror and fascination with the East. So,
well, the other side of this with the fascination at the time, of course, is linked into the sinister idea, which is opium and the, you know, the popular depiction of opium. Of, so you've got this in The Man with the Twisted Lip.
Mm.
Course, but it feeds very much into Sax Rohmer's stories and those of Thomas Burke in his The Limehouse Nights.
Yes, yeah. And I mentioned there that Conan Doyle had been experimenting with a play around the themes of Study in Scarlet, which was called Angels of Darkness. And in fact, he turned The Pot of Caviar into a very successful one-act play in 1908. And it was first performed in November 1908 at Jersey Opera House in the USA. But it came to England on the 19th of April 1910 as a curtain raiser to the House of Temperley, which was his play based on Rodney Stone. It might well have been because there was some criticism, I think, of House of Temperley not really appealing to a female audience, and so he wanted to maybe bring in something with more female characters, and this certainly has an element of that, although it has to be said that the female characters
rather grim
don't really do anything other than die, unfortunately. So it's not the best example of that. But the play A Pot of Caviar actually did go down very, very well, and it was it ended on the 9th of May, but that was probably a lesser measure of its popularity than of poor luck, because, of course, Edward VII died on the 6th of May. And that led to most of the theatre productions closing. But there are a few notable differences between the story and the play version. One of them is that the play ramps up the sentimentality, a bit like in the adaptation of A Straggler of 15, as it becomes Waterloo. It becomes slightly more sort of mawkish and sentimental in the process. So in the play version, Ainsley, the characters of Ainsley and Jessie, it's implied that there is a bit more of a kind of love interest there. But also it's heavily implied that Mercer was married and lost his wife in Sung Tong in 1889 as well. There's a little bit more characterization. There's a very nice line in here that really plays up those tensions between the Presbyterians and the Catholics. Ainsley at one point says, the only thing that really worries old Patterson is the fear that the RC Padre may pinch some of his converts when they're in the trenches. But the main difference actually is that Colonel Dressler of Germany becomes Colonel Rameau, who's described as a tall, alert, debonair Frenchman who is very much looking forward to receiving the Légion d'honneur for his defense of Icao. Whereas in the story, it's obviously Dressler who is looking forward to his Iron Cross. I wonder why it was, though, that Conan Doyle decided to make this switch.
Maybe it is this growing worry about the Germans. Although he's really, as we discussed before, when we talked about danger, he's still not really picking up on this himself. Even during the Prince Henry motor tour is when his eyes begin to open a bit, but that's after this.
Yes.
And it's not like there's a recent treaty. I think we had the Anglo-French Accord was 1902.
Yes.
Most recent accord had been with Russia in 1907. So you'd think he'd change him to a Russian, if anything, to go with the most recent political developments. I don't know, just maybe he's more dashing for the stage.
Maybe.
It could be as simple as that.
It could be, yes, it may be cock up rather than conspiracy in this case. And it might be actually that, he's obviously, it's a curtain raiser for House of Temperley. He's reusing actors. And so maybe one of them better suited the dashing debonair Frenchman than they did Colonel Dressler.
Maybe it's part of the plot to attract the ladies.
Yes, indeed. Well, that brings us to the end of this particular episode. And if you'd like to find out more, you can read the show notes at doingsofdoyle.com. And please leave us a rating or review on your podcaster of choice. It really does help us to find a new audience. Now, next time we will be hopefully slotting in a new interview show. But if not, we shall be moving on with our regular story schedule. So what have we got next time, Paul?
Yeah, well, next time, if it's one of the normal story shows, it is the 50th episode. So we've decided to choose one of our favourite stories, The Surgeon of Gasterfell.
Yes, probably one of the most important short stories that we will cover, I should think. So until then, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
I just want to assure you, gentlemen, that Her Majesty's government is not unduly alarmed by this Boxer invasion of the British Embassy.
I shall personally lodge a complaint with the Chinese Foreign Office in the morning.
And what are you going to do, Sir Arthur?
I don't know what all of you are going to do, but I intend to have a glass of champagne.
You know, I admire Sir Arthur. He always gives me the feeling that God must be an Englishman.